Welcome to Manator Tools. This week, a special edition. The first time ever in over 16 years, we have an Army versus Navy version of Manator Tools, in which me, as the Army guy, and my good friend Dave Wallace, the Navy guy, will be debating the age-old story. What is management? What is leadership? Which is better? Which is worse? Are they any different? And so on. Folks, one more time, I want to encourage you to become a licensee if you're not already one. In addition to getting access to executive tools, only licensees get executive tools and the executive tools show notes. You get access to all of our archive of all of our shows, all the show notes for our shows. I think it's over 1.5 million words that we've written in the last 16 years. And so you don't have to listen to me or any of the rest of us talk. You can just download the show notes and save yourself about 30 minutes. And of course, you also get the interviewing series, which we added during the pandemic last year because so many people were worried about their careers. The resume workbook, first job fundamentals, the effective feedback tool, roadmap, interview creation tool. I think the add-ons are actually worth more priced individually than the entire license was beforehand. Please become a licensee. It's core to who we are and what we do. We serve managers. That's what we're all about. We're doing this in part in honor of this week's upcoming Army-Navy football game, which surely we've played 120 or 130 or 150 times. And Dave is a leadership professor at the Naval Academy. They actually have positions like that at the Naval Academy. And I'm going to let him introduce himself and explain a little bit about his background, and then we're going to get right to it. So, Dave, welcome to the show.
I really appreciate you inviting me on and get a chance to talk about this.
Yeah. So, Dave, do this for us. When you and I first started talking, I don't remember us having any PhDs at West Point in leadership. I'm sure we did, but they would have talked over my head. So tell us your background.
I graduated from the Naval Academy back in 1996, and it was the great class of 96. And then I proceeded into my career as what we in the Navy call a surface warfare officer, which SWO. Means I was a destroyerman.
Right.
A SWO, that's right. So I spent nearly 20 years on destroyers of various types across the world, going on deployment, being at home, et cetera. I did in that time, I went to the Naval Postgraduate School, where I got a master's degree in IT management.
I had forgotten that, but I should tell everybody, because I've mentioned it a few times, I live in Pebble Beach in California, and the Naval Postgraduate School is about 5 miles from my house. I've spoken there before. I have friends there, so on. Okay, good. Great duty.
It's interesting. My career has been, I never intended to do a career in the Navy. I always say my wife and I made a series of decisions to not get out. And going to Monterey was one of those things that, you know, we kind of went there thinking, well, I need a master's degree to pursue my, you know, civilian career. And oh, Monterey was so beautiful, you know, got to study management and IT, and I just loved it. And I was like, oh, I could do this for a few more years. I'll just keep not getting out.
Yeah.
Until ultimately it became a, well, I guess I need to stay in now.
Because I got to retire.
And now I'm in forever.
Yeah. Okay. So you get a master's in IT management.
Right. I had a master's in IT management. That was kind of a first exposure, other than my economics undergraduate degree, to the idea of management as a field of study. That people had actually studied this, you know, this topic in which I was very interested.
Yeah.
I was like, wow, there's like science behind this. This is kind of cool. So I went through, you know, what we call my division officer tours and my department head tours, which are kind of like platoon commanders and company commanders. And then I came back to the Naval Academy to teach seamanship and navigation. And our arrival in Annapolis, my wife, who's from the beautiful city of Charlottesville, Virginia, looked at Annapolis and said, oh, I could retire here.
Yeah, a lot of people
is okay.
Say that.
Right. So I immediately started pursuing that idea. I went on to my command tour from teaching here. I went on to my command tour where I was overseas in station in Bahrain, where I was the commander of a security detachment that provided force protection to logistics ships in the area. So naval logistics ships that were operated by civilian mariners, and we sent my sailors would go on board over the horizon. So I'm not with them. They're over the horizon with machine guns to protect those mariners in the areas in, around the Middle East, the Arabian Sea, Arabian Gulf, the Red Sea, the Gulf of Aden, just places where, you know, dangerous things can happen.
Piracy, non-state actors, state actors, the whole schmear.
Exactly. And so we were providing that protection. So I had to delegate my weapons release authority to chief petty officers who were the heads of these teams operating over the horizon from me and, you know, across the area of operations. So it was a daunting command experience. So I finished that up, or while I was there, I applied for this position that was open at the Naval Academy called a permanent military professor. So I had to go take my GRE in Dubai and sent in my application, and fortunately was selected. From there, I went, through a series of negotiations, I ended up at George Mason University, where I pursued and received my PhD in industrial organizational psychology. So I always laugh when you and Mike talk about, well, you know, all you managers out there are not psychologists. I think, well, I am.
Yeah.
and you know, IO psychology is really the field you're talking about. It's the field of psychology where we deal with psychology in the workplace. And particularly my focus, of course, was on leadership and on leader development in particular, and how we develop leaders, because I knew I was coming to the Naval Academy to do just that.
Right.
And so I finished up there, and now I'm in my fifth year of teaching in this position known as a permanent military professor. I remain on active duty and stay until my statutory retirement age. And I help lead both our academic disciplines. So we have this academic approach where we do what we call formal instruction, which is one of the pillars of developing leaders. And we try and combine that with the experiences. Oftentimes we talk about the Naval Academy, I'm sure West Point uses this language as well, as a leadership laboratory.
Yes, wonderful.
Yes, I often refer to it, oftentimes it's viewed as an open laboratory where, you know, it's like chemistry class. If the professor just said, here's a bunch of chemicals, teach yourself chemistry.
Yeah.
And so we try to combine it then with the formal instruction of actually teaching leadership theory and understandings about leadership and developmental relationships. So working with what we call, I think you called tactical officers, we call them company officers, senior enlisted leaders, and even sometimes pairing them with coaches, and the idea of leadership coaches, not, you know, not just their athletic coaches, and really help them make those connections between what their experience is and what their formal instruction is, and make those two, put those two together. So I get to stay here and help do that until I'm done with my active duty days, and then I guess I'll grow up and find myself a job.
Yeah. I'm glad there are people like you at the Naval Academy attempting to teach Navy guys how to lead. I seriously am. I'm not saying that tongue in cheek. I promise you.
Yeah. And they have a similar program at West Point these days.
Oh gosh. Yeah.
And you're right. When you and I went through, or at least when I went through, there was one PhD in the leadership department, and he was actually his PhD was in mathematics. And he thought, his name was Carol Montour, and he thought great thoughts about leadership and did his best. But it was really what we refer to now as lieutenants telling sea stories. It was really what the leadership class was. And now we really try to root it in the behavioral sciences and take a more evidence-based rather than eminence-based approach.
Okay. So before we get to the leadership versus management discussion, I want to share with you a little bit about West Point. By the way, you asked me to make sure that you said at the top of the show that these are your views, not the views of the Academy, right?
Yes. So I should make it clear, you know, everything I'm saying here today, I'm not a representative of the Naval Academy per se. These are my personal views and not those of the Naval Academy, the Department of the Navy, the government, or anything other institution.
Okay, cool. And yet, I admit it, even though we like to joke about Army Navy and we cry when we lose and we laugh when we win, it's a thrill to have the show. And the idea that My best friend who happens to be at the Naval Academy right now is a leadership guy, and I'm a management guy. Just made it too good to be true that we could do Army versus Navy, leadership versus management here in the week of Army-Navy. Okay, so here was just a brief experience that I had. I graduated in 82, so I'm roughly 14 years older than you. And my experience was that West Point did not certainly teach management. I feel like I learned a lot about how to be a leader, or I was exposed to a lot. I'm not sure I was mature enough to really be great at it. I ended up discovering I was great at it toward the end of my career. But when I graduated from the academy, I did not realize how little I had been prepared to be a small unit leader in the tactical army, in the fighting army. I had been prepared to be a fantastic senior class cadet, a leader of other cadets, if you will, within a fabulous system, which I hated. I'm sure it's much like, you know, SEAL training, BUDS training. Everybody hates it, but they're glad they went through it. And every life I ever would live, I would go back to West Point and I would hate it all over again, but I would do it. But my nephew, Christer, went to West Point. He graduated like 10 years ago, and I went up for his graduation. And he was so much better prepared to be a young leader in the Army, partly through exposure to folks who had extensive small unit experience, thanks to, if you'll pardon the expression, Iran and Iraq and Afghanistan and Kuwait and so on. And I said, even though it was easier, because of course for, you know, a couple of hundred years now, the watchword is, I was at West Point, or I'm sure you say it to Naval Academy guys, when I was here, it was hard. Now they make it easier.
The last real plebe year
was yours. Yes, exactly. But I was impressed. I thought he was more ready. He had more conversations, and I felt like he knew more about the Army. So can you contrast that, West Point versus Annapolis? By the way, for those of you who don't know, West Point is Army, Annapolis is Navy. People ask me all the time, where'd you go to school? And I say, the military academy. And they say, which one? I say, there's only one. There's also a Naval Academy. There's also an Air Force Academy.
We get a similar response.
Yes,
oh, exactly. The Naval Academy. Oh, which one?
Yeah, which one? Yeah. Okay, so do you see, and you have a good perspective because it's been so many years and you're teaching leadership. Do you see the same thing in part or not at all or a lot because of the exposure to guys, you guys are doing more bringing guys back from the fleet to talk and so on?
I think yes and no. We certainly always had folks from the fleet who came back, and they were the teachers. But like I said earlier, it's lieutenants telling sea stories. They hadn't had the opportunity or directed training to reflect on their experiences in a way that to make them teachable. They really just were telling sea stories. And I can remember, I remember the sea story that I heard from my leadership instructor. This is what I remember is him saying, oh, when your sailor calls you up because he's been in a car accident, and then he called me up and said, I need you to come get the beer out of my car because I'm about to get a DUI. Yeah. And that was his leadership story. And that's not really covering what needs to be covered.
No. Yeah.
Interestingly, when I was here, monumental things happened. The first was the introduction in the Navy of what the Navy called total quality leadership.
Oh, dear God.
So Deming had, you know, introduced total quality management. And this was, you know, in the late 80s, early 90s, this had really become a thing in industry. TQM, it was going to change how we did everything. There was a lot to it in terms of measuring what you're doing.
Absolutely.
And really looking for improvement.
Yeah.
And just to even start some of the conversation, at the time, the Navy took a look at it and said, you know, we could use some of this. This makes a lot of sense, but we can't call it management because, you know, people would walk around and pull up their britches and say, we don't manage, we lead. You know, and they viewed managers as, you know, bean counters.
Right.
And they said, well, we are leaders. So they changed the name and called it Total Quality Leadership, or TQL, and instituted it. But largely remained the same. It's this idea of measuring what you were trying to do, of not expecting A while, you know, rewarding B, and really getting into this idea of taking a more scientific approach. So that was just at its infancy when I was here. And the other thing that happened is we had a massive cheating scandal when I was here.
Oh, no.
If you ever just Google the EE electrical engineering cheating scandal at the Naval Academy.
Why is it always EE? My brother was there and he graduated in 77 from West Point, and in 76, his class had a massive cheating scandal. He actually did not take the exam that everybody cheated on, but yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So this was the class, two classes ahead of me. This was actually my freshman, my plebe year, this massive cheating scandal that I would say is as close to the Naval Academy as ever come to being shut down. I mean, there were congressional hearings. Yeah. We had the NCIS came on board and did an investigation to find out what happened.
Right.
The superintendent was fired. It was a mess. And they ended up bringing in, you talk about transformational leaders. They ended up bringing in a retiring four-star named Chuck Larson. He at the time was the commander of all Pacific forces, Army, Navy, Marines, Air Force.
SINCPAC.
And he was getting ready to retire. They let him retire, and then they brought him back on active duty to take over as the superintendent. And he saved the Naval Academy. And one of the things that he did, and you've heard of Chuck Larson, he was John McCain's roommate.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know, back in that great class, and was brigade commander. He'd actually previously been the superintendent. He came back and he just overhauled our approach to ethics and integrity. He threw out the TQL course and brought in a very deep course that all of our sophomores take in ethics. And it's taught by PhD philosophers, and they get in deep into Kant and Plato and Aristotle and really deep thoughts on what it means to be a person of character. So across our curriculum now, we have 4 years of required leadership classes. Yeah. The freshmen take what we call the You're a Person class. It's titled Preparing to Lead, but it's basically an intro to psychology and sociology of, hey, you're a person. Other people are people too. And you know what? You're different from one another. And there's a lot that goes into that. So just, it's kind of about teaching self-awareness and resiliency and just kind of those beginning foundations.
Okay.
And then on our sophomore year, they all take this ethics class where they dive deep. So it's not only are you a person, you're a person of character. And so let's talk about what that means and how to be a person of character. And then in their junior year, they take the class that I really is kind of my pride and joy. And I've led for a few years, NL310, which we call Leadership Theory and Application. And it's really where the rubber meets the road on, okay, you're a person of character. Here's how to lead as a person of character. And here's how to lead other people.
Yeah, you just said two things that, of course, our listeners, probably longtime listeners, will chuckle at. You said leadership, and then you said something else, which, you know, I joke about the fact that we don't talk about leadership. It is a joke because, of course, we're talking about that kind of stuff all the time. But I just, the idea of teaching leadership to some of these people who write into me and say, I really want you to teach me leadership. And I'm like, yeah, that'll be $1 billion.
Yeah. Harold Green said, leadership cannot be taught. It can only be learned.
Learned. Exactly. You have me at a disadvantage here because my recollection of school is, of course, 40 years old. And I'm not familiar with what West Point is doing now, leadership-wise. I can say that pains me to hear about the juice scandal in the 90s. I can say that I was pleased recently when our superintendent walked back the idea that honor was a developmental effort, the honor code. For those of you who don't know, West Point and Navy, and to a certain degree, the Air Force Academy, share an honor code, which is a cadet or a midshipman. Well, not lie, cheat, or steer, and I'll tolerate those who do. Some of you remember that several years ago on a podcast, I told you my story about honor, where I was sitting next to a first classman when I was a sophomore, and he used some concert tickets at West Point that were not his, that were not for the seats that he suggested they were for, to get a better seat. And I was the lone witness against him. And a week before he graduated, he got kicked out for honor, found, what we would call found on honor, because you can neither lie nor cheat nor steal, nor can you tolerate if anyone else does it. Meaning if I see someone else do it, I'm obligated to report it. And it sounds terrible and it sounds anachronistic these days, but I can assure you, the one thing I remember is I believed everything I was told when I was leading men under fire. And if you can't believe everything you're told, if you can't believe something another commander says, as they say, all is lost. So I like the fact that you're doing the person of character. Can you give me a couple minutes more, though, on what exactly you teach? Like, when you started talking about what you teach, I thought it was way too technical for me, for us, for our audience, where you were getting into studies that were fairly academic and so on. Are you doing that in the third year course, in your junior year course?
No, we're not. I do that in my personal research, and you know, I try, and it certainly informs the class. I did try out for a semester where I had students read that, and I ended up getting reactions from them that said, this was harder than my engineering classes. Why is this so bad? And so I had to pull back a little bit. So the academic baseline informs the course, but it doesn't make up the course. We do have a textbook, but it's really written for practitioners. It's written at the undergraduate level. And there's not a ton of great textbooks out there on leadership and management, in my opinion. My not very humble opinion.
Peter Drucker. There's Peter Drucker. But it's not
right. There's Peter Drucker. But even that's kind of varsity level.
It is.
So, you know, we found what we consider to be the least worst textbook. And actually, I supplement that. One of the benefits of COVID was I made a gazillion videos of myself just teaching and lecturing about these different topics and really trying to tie in, like I said, we call it leadership theory and application.
Right.
And we really try to tie in the theory to how it supports application. So my students can't quote to you authentic leadership theory and leader member exchange theory. They don't even necessarily know those terms. What I do is bring in the core ideas of those, right? So the idea that, there's a theory out there called authentic leadership theory, which students actually do really love to hear about because they think, oh, authentic leadership, I just need to be true to myself.
That's a popular idea these days.
It is. And there is some truth to the idea that the members of your team that you are leading, they want you to be authentic. They want to see the truth. They don't want to feel like they're being lied to or that you're just putting a face on.
Right.
But at the same time, I say, well, you know, what happens if you're a jerk? You don't want to be authentic to the idea that you're a jerk.
Yeah.
And it turns out that, you know, to lead different people, different followers, different people need different forms of leadership. Some really need you to be, you know, in terms of your DISC model. Some people, you know, and you've talked many times about it within the DISC model, you adjust your communication to how the listener needs to hear you. So with some people, you take on the very high D dominating, I remember hearing, you know, you and Mike talk about it, the lunch question is, the email relating to lunch is lunch question mark?
Yeah.
And that's the beginning and end.
That's it. Yeah.
Right. Other people need to see the, hi, how are you? Hope everything's well with the family, right? They need that real high S approach. Okay. So now as a leader, you're telling me I need to change the way I communicate with people,
yes,
the way I talk to people, the way I lead them.
Right.
And at the same time, you're telling me I need to be authentic to a core ideology. And that is, again, I consider that varsity level leadership.
Yeah.
That's a hard thing to master. And I call it personally authentic flexibility. that you really need to be flexible to the demands and the affordances of the situation, which includes the people around you.
Right.
While at the same time, maintaining a core integrity and character and idea of leadership. And part of that means being willing to be vulnerable, being willing to be open about the decision-making processes, being willing to discuss why we're making a certain an approach, right? And again, you and Mike have talked about whenever you make a change in management style or a change in what you're doing overall, really saying, this is why we're making this change. This is why it's important. This is what I'm hoping to achieve. This is why I'm not going with what you wanted me to do, right? And that's always an interesting thing of what we talk about empowerment and empowering employees.
Another word we don't like here.
Certainly, there's a lot to be right. There's a lot to be said for empowerment and to make employees feel valuable, make them feel heard, make them feel like they're part of the team. And there are times when, you know, I even tell my students, you know, you're not the hero leader. You don't need to necessarily be the only person with a solution. You need to really use the diversity of thought around you to come up with the better solutions, because I guarantee somebody on that team and his or her title starts with chief. You know, they have a better idea. They very likely have a better idea of what to do than you do. So you need to be open to listening to that and really lead. And so there is something to be said for empowerment and helping people to help others to really take on that leadership mantle within the unit, while also maintaining our accountability for the final product.
Right. I was just going to say, as an aside, we're naturally going to be that way. But folks, if you hear Dave say chief and you're not quite familiar with Navy lingo, you could translate that into sergeant in the Army, and that would be helpful for you, a non-commissioned officer.
Right, or the Marine Corps.
Yeah, exactly. Folks, we're starting to get a lot of requests for 2022 from client companies who want us to come on site to deliver training. We also still do all the virtual stuff. So we have virtual effective manager, effective communicator, effective hiring manager. We also have effective remote manager, which we only do virtually. We can do all of those either on site or in person. And it depends on where your company is in terms of whether you're going back or not. One good reason to consider doing something virtually is you wouldn't have to fly everybody into one location. Logistics are a little bit easier, particularly if you've got international teams as well. So reach out to us, come to the website, or reach out to Maggie at manager-tools.com, and she'll get you sorted. I hope to see you at one of those. Okay, so I think this cast is going to go down as the one in history that there's more talk about words I have derided than any other cast ever. We've talked about authenticity. We've talked about empowerment. We talked about people feeling valuable and feeling.
Wait, heard. I can talk about culture too, if you'd like.
Oh, well, I'm okay with culture. But here's the, as I'm turning this over my head, listen to you talk about it, because I know you're smarter than me about some of this stuff. The problem is not those ideas, but how viciously and incorrectly they have been hijacked in modern culture to suggest something that is not true. The very basics of empowerment, and yes, folks, I know all these terms at some depth. I just decided I don't like them, sort of like totalitarianism. That at the very basis of empowerment, the first thing you learn is the organization doesn't empower you. You are empowered yourself, much like your plebe class, which says you're a person. You have things to offer, and you're going to be
personal
led.
Agency.
Right, exactly. Oh, agency is one of my favorite concepts. Another thing, the idea of feeling valuable. I'll tell you why that bothers me, Dave. Because if I work for you, if you're my boss, and you're doing your best to help me feel valuable, the problem with that is the measure is how I feel, not whether I actually am valued. The thing that has changed in the last 10 years, in my opinion, in management and leadership, and we can go around the tree on that one all day long, is that we have shifted the measure from what the leader does or what the organization does or what the organization purports to do. And now the entire metric is what the individual decides it is. If I do not feel valued when in fact you are an ethical, respectful, openly communicative, authentic, empowering leader, I'm screwed. All because an insecure, unknowledgeable, otherwise directed, meaning not aligned with the culture of the organization, in part our fault because we hired or assessed the wrong person, this person can hold junior leaders hostage. And I see it all the time where he doesn't make me feel valued. In a classic example, I'll use the classic popular vulgar example today, is that someone who doesn't look like me cannot make me feel valued, which, by the way, is technically a true statement as long as the standard is how the individual who is critically important and yet by definition subordinate to the organization, if that person decides that I don't feel that you have done these things. So as you were talking, I was just rolling that over my head and realizing, you know, I'm not sure I've ever said that in a cast before, but to me, all those words have incredible power when we use them in the appropriate way. I assume you guys teach them the appropriate way, but they have been hijacked by a modern culture where I think many people feel that they've lost some of their individual agency. I mean, I think we're all born with agency. We know that at some level. And then if you lose it, you want to feel that you can get it back. Now, do you have any of these kinds of discussions in class?
Absolutely. So one of the things that we start with, and this is kind of a mantra that the midshipmen can repeat over and over, is the idea that a leader delegates responsibility, but cannot delegate accountability. That ultimately you are accountable for results of retention, regardless of to whom you delegate it. And they are accountable to you for whatever it is that you delegate to them, even if they delegate it further. So that's kind of a starting point with that. And, you know, interestingly, I have really come to love, and in fact, I teach using your vernacular of results of retention, right? The idea of mission accomplishment and team viability. And I say, right, Here's how you remember it. Results of retention. Here's a podcast. You know, it's interesting because I told you I teach the juniors, and when they come to me, they've spent 2 years as underclassmen, 1 year as plebes, and then kind of the disrespected youngsters, sophomores, yeah, who, you know, they're not plebes anymore, but we call it a plebe with an anchor because they get to wear an anchor on their collar,
right,
and now they're no longer a plebe. But they come to us, and I often look at them, and I use the term, they are victims of leadership. So they have been led for a couple of years. They haven't really had the chance to lead yet. And so their view of leadership is as the victims of leadership. And oftentimes I think this is even an issue in industry of that first time manager has been a victim of management, a victim of leadership for years. And now they're going to be the ones who are different. They're going to take care of their people. And it's all service, you know. They love to talk about servant leadership, and I'm a big believer in servant leadership. The idea of putting, you know, a leader's responsibility is to develop her followers. Absolutely.
Sure.
I think that's really important. On the other hand, there is a mission accomplishment that needs to be done.
Yeah.
We actually need results. If you focus solely on retention, you're not going to be the manager for very long.
Yeah.
And, you know, we had a chief of naval operations who used to talk about, so back in the day, we used to say, you know, people first, people first, people first. And then when Admiral Vern Clark, he used to tell this story about the USS John F. Kennedy was an aircraft carrier stationed in Florida. And 1 year they failed a major engineering inspection. And the week before they were supposed to go on
that
deployment.
That would have been a nuclear aircraft carrier, so it was an Oris.
It was a conventional aircraft carrier.
Oh, okay.
It was an in-serve inspection.
Okay.
And they failed.
Oh, my.
And they were supposed to go on deployment the next week and relieve the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower on deployment.
Oh, my.
And so, you know, what happened? Those sailors on that ship, we're talking, the week before they're going on deployment, which is usually a time when you spend time with your family and kind of get all those last family minutes in, they're working 24-hour days, fixing everything.
Yeah.
Under the worst of circumstances. And then they're supposed to go on a 6 to 9 month deployment.
Right.
And, and so Admiral Clark, who was the chief of naval operations at the time, he came out and said, we keep saying sailors first. Well, I can tell you when I made the decision that those sailors were going to stay on board and fix that ship so she could go on deployment, I don't think they felt valued. I don't think they felt like we were putting sailors first. What we were was putting the mission first.
Yep.
And so he would say the real answer is mission first, people always. The idea that the reason that we take care of our people is because they are the ones who actually accomplish the mission.
Right.
And so you heard when we first talked, I told you my mantra is leadership is what the followers do. That ultimately a leader, a manager, can do whatever she wants, can give orders and try to use all the legitimate power and all the other sources of power that she can. But if nobody does anything, right, if nobody follows me up the hill, I'm just a dude going for a walk. And it's the action of the team that accomplishes the mission. And this is why all those words about empowerment and agency and valuing, and why the way the person feels actually is important, because oftentimes when we don't feel like we're a valued member of the team, we don't participate. So there is something to be said for providing that value. I'm sure you've heard the term psychological safety.
Yes.
And this is that idea that any member of the team can speak up and will not be at risk for raising their hand and saying, I have a different idea. This may be dangerous. This may be, unethical, or I just think maybe my idea is better. And then how the leader reacts to that, shutting them down, right? Telling them, how dare you question my legitimate authority? You've talked before about the power move of putting the glasses down on the nose.
Yes.
And looking over the glasses of saying, how dare you question my authority in this matter? And it is a problem. And it really leads to ineffective solutions.
Yes, it does. Inefficient. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, it is. And so when people feel like they're a part of the team, when they have the ability, the right, they are not at risk for speaking up. And, we talk about diversity and inclusion, right? That's the kind of the buzzwords of the day, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
And the reason we want diversity, and by the way, folks, it's not just racial diversity. It's not just gender diversity. Those things are important.
It's behavioral diversity.
But it's also diversity of function, diversity of thought, diversity of idea.
Exactly.
Yes. And the reason we want diversity is because I can't solve everything on my own. I don't have all of the knowledge in the universe. I'm not omniscient. I don't know what the correct answer is every time. I need to be able to use the diverse ideas of a team to come up with the best way to accomplish the mission. And the reason we say inclusion is because diversity is not an end goal. Diversity is a means to the end goal. And if I'm not inclusive in my leadership, if I don't really leverage, make people feel valued and like their opinions can be heard and should be heard, then I lose all the value that I've created by having this diverse team. And I really have this diverse and inclusive leadership style that leads to effectiveness. So it's people. And I don't want to say the means just, the ends justify the means. And I don't want to make it sound like I'm saying use people to get to your ends. But it's about I accomplish the mission. I get to results and efficiency by affecting retention, by taking care of my people and achieving team viability.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I will drill down into one particular thing you said. You asked me if I knew what psychological safety was, and we're on Zoom, so I can see you, but I rolled my eyes a little bit because that's another example of something that has been co-opted in a way that's not helpful. You use the example of if I'm on your team, I feel psychologically safe in saying, hey, Commander Wallace, what about this? Well, there's a couple of things that go into that. One, if I'm 22 and I don't know my head from a bowling ball, nobody's taught me yet that I'm not supposed to suggest different ideas or argue with your idea once the decision has been made. Mm. There are times when, you know, when we're ideating, when you say to me, hey, anybody got any ideas? If I keep my mouth shut, you know, he who is silent consents, and then only after the decision has been made and now we're working on things, I say to you, well, I don't like this decision, so I'm not going to be involved in it. To me, that's one of those things where I want my voice to be heard. Well, no, sorry. There are rules about that. It's not free play all the time. Another thing, psychological safety. If I come to you after the decision has already been made, after we're already actioning things, we're moving toward the mission, and I complain or I disagree or whatever, and you say, Mark, now's not the time. Sailor, now's not the time. And now I go and talk to whatever passes for HR in the Navy, and I say, well, I don't feel psychologically safe with Commander Wallace. In today's world, that is enough to derail a career. It's funny you mentioned the story of the Kennedy, because that's actually the origin story in a way for Manator Tools, that Mike and I were in a unit where our battalion commander, certainly not the commander of an aircraft carrier, a battalion, I think we had 600 people. I think a modern aircraft carrier has 5,000. And I'm fairly certain that the commanders, the captains of aircraft carriers and wing commanders are fairly elite people in the Navy.
Yes.
It's not like there are 1,000 of them, but that's a potentially career-ending move to fail something like that. Our battalion commander, before Mike got there, failed his RTEP, his Army Training and Evaluation Program, and was later relieved, and we got a new commander and changed our lives. But if I don't know when to do that, and then I feel psychologically unsafe around you, and I go to someone who is considerate of my situation, all you need have in today's world, in the Navy, I would guess in the Army, I'm guessing here, but certainly in corporate America, if some young person were to say, I don't feel psychologically safe around Mr. Horstman or Commander Wallace, that would be the kiss of death. And in fact, we behave with, you and I as leaders and managers, behave with ethical respect and dignity and kindness and so on. But because the young person is not taught, doesn't know, and has been led to believe that psychological safety is, I must never feel at risk. I must never feel tension. I must never feel conflict. I must always feel safe, which of course doesn't fly in an organizational world, because really, truly effectiveness happens on the border between safety and chaos. It's part of humanity's history. The study of ethics will teach you that. That's what worries me. And that's part of the reason why, as I started to see that in my career, I realized that the answer over and over again becomes behavior. It's interesting. At the time, I wasn't smart enough to appreciate it, but in the Army, we had a phrase that is now out of vogue, but we even got bumper stickers. And I think it was Field Manual 1-5, which is sort of the core field manual. It's like leadership for small arms unit leaders. And it was be, no, do, meaning here are the ways you need to be in terms of ethical, to your point, you're a person of character. And then here are the things you need to know. In other words, you need to understand your job. You need to have technical, tactical, operational, logistical competence, which, by the way, I thought the Army did a good job of that. And then here are the things you need to do. But it really broke down pretty quickly on do. You would almost have to give examples, sailors telling sea stories, and then help people draw a conclusion, a larger conclusion, infer a lesson, if you will, from the activity, from the behavior that people took. And I can remember very clearly in my first, before I sold my first company and we started Manator Tools, thinking to myself, we have to teach behavior. Because if I try to teach the state of mind, if I try to teach how to feel, we're doomed. We're absolutely doomed. And listening to you talk about what you guys teach and the way you build up from plebe year through, we would call them yearlings, sophomores, and so on, is reassuring. What do you guys do senior year?
So senior year, they take a law course. We actually have JAG teach a course.
We took that junior year.
Okay. So it's a very practical, they call it law for the junior officer. And it's like, here's how you be an investigating officer. This is, you know, how court martials work. Here's, you know, all these things. But, you know, and I have to admit, I often wondered, you know, why do we teach this law course? This seems, you know, this isn't leadership. What are we doing? And I sat down with a JAG, the lead JAG one time, and she and I sat down and I was like, okay, what, you know, how do you view this in the leadership continuum?
Right.
And she said, okay, well, you teach them everything that they maybe ought to do and should aspire to do as leaders. We tell them what the minimum floor is.
Okay.
It's interesting. You know, the UCMJ actually, if you read it in the right frame of mind, you realize that it provides, that's the Uniform Code of Military Justice, which is the
military law,
the law that governs the military, really provides a floor. It requires leaders to lead. Officers and senior enlisted are expected to lead. And if you do not lead, you can be brought up on charges. Now, you know, the words aren't, you didn't lead, but it's, you know, you are accountable for the behaviors of the people who work for you and the ethics around that. And you are also accountable for taking care of your people. If you treat your people unfairly, if you treat them unethically, you can expect, whether it's a non, you know, what we call administrative, non-judicial, you know, proceedings, or even potentially judicial proceedings.
Yeah, exactly.
You could be court-martialed. And in fact, back in the day, they don't do it as much anymore. But interestingly, if you read, you know, the Jack Aubrey novels, you know, or if you read, you know, there's interesting, you know, the South Seas Expedition and other great naval adventures. When those sailors, when those commanders would return, there was always a court-martial.
Yes.
Where they would just kind of go through all the complaints and grievances that came up, and they would be court-martialed, and a board of inquiry would be held, and the board would say whether or not they led well. We don't do it quite as formally anymore, but there's still a retention of. Yes.
Absolutely.
There is a floor of leadership that is legally required.
One of the things that's going in, things I think this actually went out last week, but is also relevant to that, is that when naval commanders got their orders in the Age of Sail, back when Jack Aubrey was sailing, around the time of Napoleon, if you're wondering when that is, the turn of the 19th century, their orders included a line: fail not at your peril. If you were commander of a ship that lost a naval battle and there were investigations, if not all hands were lost, for instance, if there were survivors after you were paroled from your likely captivity, you were brought before a board of inquiry and a court-martial was convened, and you could very easily be hung for being entrusted with the king's or queen's ship and failing. Fail not.
Yeah.
At your peril.
Love it.
So, okay, one more thing. What do you hear from young graduates who go out into the fleet or in the various places that Naval Academy graduates go about the usefulness of what you're teaching? And I'll tell you why. I want you to know why I'm asking that. I have been trying for years. Mike and I benefited, you benefited, from being given some basic instruction. We could call it leadership. We could call it management. I think everything we've been talking about today, you could describe as management or leadership. I think Manager Tools spends an awful lot of time talking about leadership. And I think the debate will never be settled.
I think so as well.
Yeah. And frankly, I think it's sophistry. It's speciousness when people say to me, well, you're talking about this or that. I said, dude, you can't even define leadership. And it doesn't even matter. It's how many angels can fit on the head of a pin. But we got some basic grounding in the principles, the ideas behind leadership, and to some degree, management. Although the services are much more likely to call it leadership than they are management, a la TQL and TQM.
Right.
And so we were a little bit better prepared. I have long said that young professionals, young college graduates or high school graduate or tech school graduates are not taught the basics of professionalism, are not taught the basics of organizational life. And I don't think there's any move afloat to teach them that. And so therefore, I think in much the same way that history will show that organizations, when they don't get what they want, build systems in place to make sure it happens And in this case, it would be in the form of basic professional training, a la the effective professional, which I'm working up now. What do you see? What do you hear from young ensigns and lieutenants and so on that go out in the fleet and then come back and talk to you, perhaps mids whom you've befriended, talking to you about what they learned and what the Navy is really like?
You know, it's interesting. When I speak to them, I guess there's a couple things that come to mind to answer that question. One is they often enact what we have taught without knowing it. Right. And so if I talk to them, I actually recently conducted a research study where I was really trying to dive into how team leadership works. So if we think of like a platoon commander and the sergeant work together to lead, right? That's really a team leadership.
Yes.
A team of leaders at the head. You know, certainly the officer is accountable, but the senior enlisted is right there next to her, leading along the way.
Right.
And so I conducted a research study. Okay, what does this really mean when we talk about these team of leaders and how they operate together?
Right.
And I conducted all these interviews with senior enlisted leaders and with junior officers about how does this work and how did this work for you? When did it go well? When did it not go well, et cetera? And what I found was when they said it went well, it was really about operating as a team. And it was all the team leadership stuff that we had taught them. But they couldn't necessarily put the words to it, right? They couldn't necessarily say, well, we held, you know, they were doing one-on-ones. They just wouldn't have called it a one-on-one and wouldn't have recognized it as such. But that's what they were doing. You know, and what we call, you know, in the leadership literature, we talk about team charters, right? Which is kind of the ground rules for how a team works.
Right.
You know, and you set that up at the beginning and you adjust it explicitly as you need to. And they would never say, well, we sat down and figured out our team charter.
Yeah.
But they would say, you know, we kind of had some ground rules for, you know, who was going to do what and how it was going to work. And we'd meet at these times. We had a routine that we set up. So that's one piece to it is they do the things. They just don't necessarily know where it came from.
Right.
What I find even more interesting is sometimes when we have folks come back to teach. Right. They'll come back. They spend a few years in the fleet and then they come back to be a company officer, to be an instructor. And we take them through the course because, you know, maybe they're helping us teach. And so we're taking them through the curriculum and they'll sit there and they're with wide eyes and say, why didn't you teach me this stuff? And then I say, well, we did.
Yeah.
And that's why that tying to experience and having that coach to really help you explicitly tie what you're learning in the classroom to what you're doing on the playing field or in your club or wherever else is so important because, you know, you can hear all this stuff, but until you really experience a leadership position and being standing there as the one holding the bag, you know, it's hard to put all that stuff together.
Yeah. Have you guys at Navy, have you gone away? When I was there, we had something called the fourth class system and plebes were lower than, as we like to say, plebes were outranked all the admirals in the whole damn Navy, but we were lower, plebes were lower than everything else. And in the last 40 years, they've changed to what they call a four class system, which is plebes are not hazed, but rather simply the lowest ranking members of the Corps and are led with ethics and integrity and so on. Is there a similar shift that has happened at Navy?
And certainly the plebe system has changed. There was a time when it was really hazing.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, kids getting beat up and everything else.
Yeah.
And that has really very much gone away. You know, there's still plebes and they are still the lowest of the classes and they are subject to verbal intensity.
Yeah, that's a nice way of putting it.
Yeah, they get hollered at a lot.
Yeah.
And there is a, you know, certainly there is an aspect to that of building your ability to deal with stress and build some resilience that I do believe in. But it's certainly to quote George H.W. Bush, it's a kindler, gentler Navy than it was, you know, maybe 30 years ago.
Yeah.
At the same time, what actually I find interesting is when I was a midshipman, a senior, a first class midshipman, could tell a second class midshipman what to do, and they would receive this order and do it.
Ah.
And even among the first class midshipmen, you know, if you had a certain number of stripes because you were the company commander as opposed to the platoon commander or the company XO or whatever as a midshipman, you know, I remember I was a three striper in my senior year. And so I could walk into our common area, what we call the ward room, and I could say, you know what, I want to watch a baseball game. We're going to change the channel. And because I outranked everybody in the room, they would have to do that.
Yeah.
So I remember I got to watch Cal Ripken's, you know, final game because I walked in the room and said, this is what we're going to watch, and they would have to do it.
Yeah, that would never happen at Army.
Well, I think that's
rank changed. Among firsties would never. Yeah.
Right. So I think that's really changed now, where it's really they see each other as peers. And what's interesting is then to teach them how to lead peers without pure legitimate authority.
Yeah.
Right. It's not just about your legitimate power.
Yeah.
It's how do you lead with expert power, with the referent, you know, relationship power? How do you do that with people who are your peers? How do you conduct, you know, what you guys call peer one-on-ones?
Right.
How do you even do that? And, you know, and how does that, you know, operate where you are ostensibly responsible for evaluating this person and directing her efforts? You know, how do you manage that with she sees you as a peer?
Yeah. All right, look, we could talk about this forever, but we've been talking for nearly an hour, and I'm sure our audience is like, okay, enough. So I want to leave you with a couple of thoughts. Dave, thank you for being at the Naval Academy and for making it the great place that it is. Yeah, folks, if your kids are thinking about joining the service and they're thinking about attending a service academy, I can assure you, it was one of the smartest things I ever did. As I said earlier, I'd go back in every life I would ever lead. If they can't.
Absolutely.
Yeah, same for you.
I would absolutely agree.
Yeah.
And say that, you know, my intention was never to be in the Navy for a career. Coming to the West Point or Annapolis is not about necessarily making a career and you're committing the rest of your life. But it is about dedicating your life to being a leader.
Yes.
And to serving others.
Yes, I agree. And folks, if your son or daughter cannot get into Army, I would encourage them to apply to the Naval Academy. It's also a great place. But maybe not the Air Force Academy. And Dave, thank you for what you do. Thank you for taking the time. This will always go down as one of my all-time favorite casts. I think you're the only like fourth or fifth guest we've had on the show in the last 16 plus years. This is coming out the week of Army Navy. And so I'm going to allow you to say something on air that has never been uttered and never will again. And what's that?
Go Navy, beat Army.
Yeah. I don't know. It just sounds so much more natural to say, go Army, beat Navy. So best wishes to the Navy football team. I wish they play well. I wish it's a close game, a nail biter. I hope we win. I will be there in person. And I promise I'll call you sometime afterwards and either gloat or congratulate you for another great game. By the way, I just checked. I think there's been about 120 games, and you guys are ahead 60 to 50, roughly.
Yeah.
You guys had a long run of like, I think 13 in a row against
us. Oh, it's crazy.
It was really heartbreaking for us, but we're starting to be better now. So, Dave, thank you. This is a treat. And a hoot. Thank you for taking the time away from what I know is a busy schedule.
Mark, my pleasure. And I hope we get to do it again, frankly.
Yeah, let's do it again. We'll spend more time preparing and get really deeply technical about authenticity and leadership and maybe ethics. I could absolutely get excited about doing a whole series on ethics, on the foundational principles of ethics and Socrates and Plato and Kant and Aristotle. It would be exciting.
Hey everyone, this is Mike. I just want to jump in quickly and thank Dave for joining Marker on today's podcast. What an honor it was to have Dave sharing his thoughts on leadership. Those of you who listened while know we don't host guests on our show very often. It's almost unheard of. That tells you right there just how much we value Dave and his thoughts. So Dave, thank you again. What a great thing for us. So everyone, that's it for this week. We'll see you next time. Until then, have a great one. All the best.